The content of this podcast should not be considered financial or investment advice. All interviews and discussions are opinions only, and the podcast has been created without taking into consideration the listener's financial objectives, financial situation, or needs. Listeners should obtain independent advice before making any financial decisions. This is Barry Fitzgerald, Garen Perrow columnist for StockEd. Welcome to another edition of the Explorers podcast. Today we're catching up with Arafura Resources. It trades under the code ARU or Alpha Romeo Uniform and is trading at 36 cents for a market cap of about 565 million. Now, I just mentioned there that back in January 2020, when we caught up with Arafura, the company was trading at about 8 cents for a market cap of 83 million. Mind you, at the same time, Lynas Corp was trading at about $1.76 billion. So Lynas is now an $8 billion company. So from all that, we can gather that something is going on big time in the rare earth space. And Arafura, of course, through its Nolans project, about 125 k's north of Alice Springs in the Northern Territory, is poised to become Australia's second rare earth producer, but perhaps just as important, the only one in Australia to provide separated rare earth oxides. So a very interesting story. And again, we've got Gavin Lockyer, the managing director, with us today to bring us up to speed with the story. And I would probably start out, Gavin, by welcoming you to the podcast and might get you to start with what was the kick in the share price we saw in mid-March that seems to have been a bell to people saying Nolans is finally on its way into production.
Yeah, thanks, Barry. It's great to be back, and good day to all the listeners out there. Look, I think a number of things are going on in the critical minerals, or in our particular case, the neodymium, praseodymium market. We're seeing obviously some geopolitical issues going on in terms of limited supply being able to come out of China due to COVID restraints on magnet production, which has affected globally the auto sector in particular. Compounding that is the restriction in materials now coming out of Russia, obviously due to the sanctions and the conflict that's occurring over there. So you've got some geopolitical issues going on. On top of that, we've just got a growing market in terms of electric vehicle sales. These sales are growing month on month, year on year, and everybody knows that electric vehicles require, roughly 2 kilograms of rare earth magnet in each one, and so there's just been a massive demand for product against a backdrop of restricted supply, and people are looking for alternatives. Arafura represents one of the very few opportunities outside of China, which can come online in the near term in order to meet that looming demand supply deficit. So I think it's really been a realization of the market that there's only a few projects out there. Lynas, as you mentioned, was one of them. They're in production and obviously having a stellar performance in terms of market cap, and we're following, although albeit not so stellar, but we hope to get there very soon.
Now, some of what you were saying there is reflected, of course, in the NdPr pricing. Notice I won't try and pronounce them. Of US$152 a kilogram in the most recent quarter, up about 14%. I seem to remember that your feasibility work you've been doing on your project, you assumed a long-term price of around US$87 a kilo. Is the 87 kilo still stand as a long-term projection, or do you think everyone's going to have to start thinking higher prices, long run?
Oh, look, I think higher prices is the norm. We have, since the feasibility study, which was done in February 2019, and we updated it in May last year, we've had subsequent third-party reports done, and they're showing a much higher longer-term price. We'll plan to publish that alongside updated capital and operating costs later this year as we get towards FID. But certainly $87 now seems very conservative. Mm. Interesting that at the time, I think the actual spot price was around $55 a kilogram. So having offtake discussions with groups and us trying to put floor prices in at about $87 was, you know, it almost sounded like we were dreaming. But as we stand now, we're in a pretty good position in terms of price negotiation.
I could just see myself at the time asking you a question, aren't you being a bit optimistic with 87 a kilo there, given the spot price?
Yeah.
So times change. Now, talking about times changing, there is this government-to-government discussions around the need to supply critical metals, obviously rare earths being a key part of that, where you've got Europe, North America, Australia being part of this response that is going on. That's coming through in quite a bit of government support for your project. So can we just run through the three key ones there, the Modern Mining Initiative, the Export Finance NAIF debt facility, and the Korean government's COMIA, which is facilitates rare earths to the Korean market. Can we just run through those to give people a feel about how big this government response is to wean the world off China's grip on rare earths?
Yep, you've hit the nail on the head there. It's about the rest of the world actually identifying that it needs to find alternate supply, and this is not a Sinophobic argument. This is simply a fact that China will need all its own production for its own manufacturing, like any good country would do, it will protect its own manufacturing industry ahead of others, and that's really all China is doing here. And they're, even the producers in China are struggling to meet their external supply contracts with current manufacturers. And so the Australian government, along with many of its allies, over the last couple of years has been developing a critical mineral strategy. Austrade in particular has been really forthright here in promoting Australia and Australian projects globally. And over time, that has morphed into discussions with Australian government itself saying, well, you know, other governments are prepared to put money in, but they'd like to see the Australian government actually putting money where its mouth is. And so it's from Arafura's perspective, it's morphed into a number of those facilities that you've mentioned. The first one is the Modern Manufacturing Initiative. And again, I should say, given we're in the middle of an election cycle, that most of these government processes have been extremely bipartisan. And that's been, I think, again, a reflection of the importance of this sector. But the Modern Manufacturing Initiative was is a grant that's been provided to us for up to $30 million. We have to spend $60 million to get that $30 million. But the target is that is for the last phase of our processing plant, which is the rare earth separation plant. That's the part of the plant that takes all the mixed rare earth products and separates out the NdPr. And it's also been granted along the lines that it's modern manufacturing, so it's downstream modern downstream manufacturing in Australia. So it's not just dig it up and ship it out, but also with the view that we could potentially take other feedstocks from other rare earth feedstocks, whether it be in the mineral sands game or just other pure rare earth plays. The second one you mentioned was Export Finance Australia and NAIF, and they are more longer-term project funding facilities, up to $300 million combined over a longer tenor. It's a debt facility subject to a number of conditions precedent, including securing bankable offtakes, as well as looking to get fixed price EPC contracts wherever possible. And then the last one, which is, I guess, the international collaboration with COMIR and the Australian the Korean government, whereby the Korean government is trying to encourage Australian entities to basically sell and execute offtake agreements with Korean manufacturers, whether it be in the auto sector, in the technology sector, the electronic sector, or just Korean industry more widely, and in exchange for that, then the Korean government will step in and provide what's called untied guarantee schemes, where they will underwrite the offtake agreement such that we can then go out and raise commercial debt. So all three of those are extremely important to our overall funding strategy.
Uh-huh. And in terms of funding, it is a big project, $1.1 billion or thereabouts. FI final investment decision expected in the second half of this year.
That's correct.
What are the? I imagine you have to get through the front-end engineering and design phase, the project funding, of course, and offtake partners. So yep. We can take those one by one. Where are you at?
Yep, 100% correct. So the front-end engineering design was initiated middle of last year, and we have been working on that extensively throughout second half of last year, and it won't be completed until early Q3 this year. And the target there is to get our engineering sufficiently advanced to enable constructors to adequately tender. What we have been doing, however, is bringing constructors into the discussion early. We brought them in a couple of months ago, actually, to start looking at a constructability review. That helps basically guide the engineering to make sure that what they're designing is actually constructible. And we also hope that will give the constructors a good understanding of the project and the intricacies of the project, so that when we ask them for fixed price EPC kind of style contracts, that they're more informed than perhaps they otherwise would be, and therefore obviously keep contingencies and other variable costs down in their fixed pricing. In terms of the funding, we appointed our mandated lead arrangers last week. That was SocGen and NAB, two banks that have strong metals and mining backgrounds. Those groups will now be helping us facilitate the overall debt sizing and bringing together the Export Finance Australia and the NAIF facilities, so that we can identify the exact debt to equity ratios. Right. We have published some of that information previously. But obviously, overall debt is requires clear bankable offtakes. So that's been the other key focus of the group. We've had people recently going through Korea, advancing discussions that we had pre-COVID. We've had a team camped in Europe for a couple of weeks, again, to continue discussions that we're having pre-COVID and continued through COVID, in an effort to advance these term sheets to a more announceable offtake arrangement, and ones that the banks can actually put their hands on and say, right, subject to funding, obviously, these groups will be there to support the project in terms of volumes of offtake. And we're talking, you know, reasonable names here that are obviously recognizable to the everyday punter, but also are very bankable from the lender's perspective.
Right. Okay. And did I see a line in one of the in a recent presentation that you're more than 10 offtake partner discussions accounting for 260% of production, planned production?
Absolutely. Look, we've got, you know, we're spreading ourselves across jurisdictions. We've focused on those jurisdictions where we believe rare earth magnets are critical to manufacturing and industry. And predominantly that's, you know, our key trading partners in Europe, Korea, Japan, and the USA. And we've also linked or attempting to link those offtake contracts with assistance in our debt. So if it's in a jurisdiction, as I said, like Korea or Germany or Japan, where they have existing export credit agencies, where we're looking to link the offtake with untied loan guarantees, which will assist us with the debt funding, and in jurisdictions where they aren't necessarily prevalent, where we're trying to seek some form of equity contribution from the potential off-takers themselves, whether it be at parent level or preferably at the project level.
Okay. And like the governments of the world, the end consumers of the world need to start thinking about putting up to, break this nexus of China's stranglehold on the business.
You're absolutely right. And I think we saw it with the auto sector in particular around the batteries and buying into lithium, cobalt, graphite, nickel, etc. Because they realise that it's not just the battery manufacturer's issue now, it's their issue. And so we're now hopefully in the next phase of that procurement supply chain strategy that many of these groups have undertaken, and hopefully that they're now, they are looking at securing supply of their rare earths for their magnets.
Yeah, sure. Something strategically that interests me is the spending the money on the rare earth separation plant, $90 odd million. Why have you gone down that pathway and not simply do what a lot of our mining industry has done for decades, just ship off lower value raw materials?
Look, for us, it was we did contemplate that. Don't get me wrong. It's much easier to dig it up and just ship it out. The issue, I guess, we had was that we've got a large capital cost project. We felt that if we undertook that model, that perhaps the price that we might get from the processor, and all of those processors currently reside in China, might be sufficient in order to give us a modest return, but would probably never be sufficient for us to be able to raise capital on our own basis to build the bigger plant and the downstream processing. So that was one reason. Second reason is the value add in that last 100 million of capital. We almost double the value of our rare earth product. So the NPVs improve significantly by going down to a rare earth oxide. By doing a rare earth oxide, we also offer our customers a complete outside of China supply chain. So we can actually deliver our product to a automaker. We won't be delivering it in form of a magnet or a component, but through their various supply chain suppliers outside of China, we can actually provide them with a line of sight as to where that product has come from, and it would be completely outside of China. And the third part of that is really one that's grown in importance in the last 12 months. It's not just the line of sight to the product that we can offer the customer, but it's line of sight around ESG. And the fact that we're doing everything in Australia, a well-known jurisdiction for mining and processing, we have all our environmental approvals to do all of this at one site. We can show our customer that we're operating in accordance with world's best practice, both at an environmental level and operational level, and also all our wastes are managed in an appropriate manner. And this is a really big selling point for customers globally, particularly in the green sector, where wind turbines and electric cars.
Yes, no, they're very attuned to the ESG credentials of the where the product's coming from. Kind of makes sense, I guess, if you're in the green space, that you want green supply of materials as well. Otherwise, the hypocrisy will be quickly found out by.
Absolutely.
Okay. Now, I think a good way to finish up would be to give investors a feel for how significant this project can be in terms of percentage of world demand, what sort of earnings capability figures you have. I know they'll be updated as we go through, but what were the most recent ones? Just to give people a feel for how significant this project is.
Yeah, look, when in production, we'll be targeting somewhere between 5% and 10% of global supply at this point in time. And we're targeting production by end of 2025. And so, we think that that's a really good time to be coming into production, because it's around where most forecasters are saying that China will become a net importer, and therefore the world will be crying out for more product. So, we won't be an insignificant supplier. In terms of the product itself, the mine site itself, we offer longevity. We have a mine life that's JORC compliant to around 38, 39 years. But we do have mineralization, and this is in the top 200 meters vertical depth. Mm-hmm. But we've got mineralization down 440 meters. So this is an extremely significant deposit on a global scale. That in turn allows us to offer so many different things for the region in which we operate. And so we are working closely with our communities in Central Australia around making intergenerational change in the region, but also working with the Australian government and the Northern Territory government about advancing the modern manufacturing initiatives that we are stating here, that it's offering a whole range of new skill sets for Australians. And so we think that's a fantastic opportunity. When the MPVs and IRRs are all published on our website, and we are not expecting any significant changes there. But what I will say is that post capital payback, which currently sits at around 5 years, the EBITDA or free cash carry is quite significant. In the it's a couple of hundred million US dollars per annum. So I think the economics speak for themselves in terms of long term. Once investors can get their head around the upfront big capital number that we have, I think if you start looking at it as a bit of an annuity, I don't think that's a bad way to look at this project.
Right. Okay. There we go, folks. Arafura, Nolan's day has finally arrived. Very much plugged into the green energy revolution through the Nolan's project, which is shovel ready. So watch out for those re-rating points as the year unfolds, the final investment decision, and getting into production around 24-25. So with that, Gavin, thanks for your time today. Exciting project. Wish you all the best with it, and we'll keep in touch.
Absolutely. Thanks, Barry. Thanks for your time.
Cheers.